Welcome to the Apple Context Machine, a podcast about all things Apple, with your hosts, Jeff Gamet and Brian Chaffin.
Today is September 18th, 2009, and this is the Apple Context Machine, episode number 155, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor for TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, your Indian tech support specialist. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, was that too much? You can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything, for instance, my taste, my appropriateness, my poor sense of judgment.
We let you out in public.
Shoot us a note at ACM at macobserver.com. And by the way, to anyone... Anyway, yeah, just go ahead and let me have it. I'm all right with that.
You know, the problem is I laugh, and that encourages you.
It's true. I didn't spring that one. I often don't spring my weekly titles on Jeff until we actually record so that we get an honest That's reaction true. Out of him.
And yeah, my laughter is genuine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you, buddy.
Including the full-on snort at the beginning of that one.
Well, if you would like to see what makes us snort in the rest of our daily lives, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at twitter.com/TMOBrian, and that's Brian with a Y.
And I'm at... What am I? I'm at...
J Gamet,
yeah, with a J.
Yeah, that's J-G-A-M-E-T. So
right.
As opposed to J-A-Y.
Right. I'm so glad you know how to spell my Twitter name, because apparently this evening I'm incapable of doing that myself.
Right. Well, it's been a couple of weeks. It's been an interesting couple of weeks.
It has. I guess some stuff happened.
Yeah, some things happened. Apple did some stuff. Mm-hmm.
Right. Microsoft did some stuff.
Mm-hmm. Microsoft did some silly stuff.
Those wacky zany
guys.
Some things.
I got my hair colored. A different color.
Oh, sweet.
I've been artificially blonde for 9 years and maybe more. And now I'm more. I'm closer to my natural color, though. It's kind of an unnatural version of my natural dark brown.
Now, see, that's just intriguing right there.
Well, and my stylist insisted that what I really needed this time around was a pompadour. If you look at my forum picture, you'll see big hair. Now, that picture is actually probably a year or two old, but my hair had gotten that big again, and I wanted to keep making it bigger. And my stylist decided that what I really needed was a pompadour. So I've got kind of a pompadour thing, and I'm trying to figure out what the hell I'm going to do with it.
You know, what I'm hoping is that at least one of our listeners goes and grabs your forum picture, mm-hmm. whips out Photoshop, and puts a pompadour on and sends it to us.
Love me tender, love me sweet.
Yeah, I'm excited already.
All right, well, I guess it seemed like a good time to get to the show.
Oh, sure. I guess as long as we're both here, we might as well.
Yeah, might as well.
Apple might be happy with the way it handles music royalties, but the recording industry isn't, so the group is taking its complaints all the way to Congress. iTunes 9 has some cool new features, including iTunes LP. Microsoft declared war on the iPod with its Zune HD. And Star Trek and Mac fans are all over Gene Roddenberry's old Mac.
That doesn't sound right, Jeff.
I crack me up.
Okay, the music industry, in this case performing rights groups like ASCAP and BMI, which you've probably heard of, is looking for ways to generate new revenue from downloaded content. And having proved to be utterly incapable of doing so in the marketplace, it's taking the next obvious step of turning to Congress in hopes of passing legislation that would force companies like Apple and Amazon to pay additional royalty fees. If passed, media download services would have to pay royalty fees for the songs played in movies and TV shows, and for the 30-second track samples users can preview before buying a song. Good Lord. Music industry, again, BMI and ASCAP, are claiming that songwriters and composers aren't getting paid royalties for their works if they are included in downloaded versions of movies and TV shows, and who better to provide that compensation than the retail stores doing the selling? Even better, they're also claiming that 30-second song samples consumers can listen to at the iTunes Store and other online music services constitutes a public performance and, as such, should be paid for. Internet downloads, according to the music industry, mark a big shift in the way consumers get music, movies, and TV shows, and the current model doesn't properly account for that change. Jonathan Potter, executive director at the Digital Media Association, does not agree. He said, quote, "This is a turf battle. They are saying the songwriters aren't getting paid. Baloney," he said. "Songwriters are getting paid," he said. And he asserted that they're getting paid through the payment of sync rights and mechanical rights that are already in place and that cover these particular usages that BMI and ASCAP are looking to get money for. Assuming that music industry lobbyists can get Congress to pick up the torch and pass the laws at once, however, the end result would be higher media download prices for consumers, and that could lead to fewer sales, which is what the music industry as a whole seems to excel at the most these days. Frickin' idiots. What the hell?
I don't know.
We should talk about this in a context machine.
Oh, hey, yeah. That sounds like a great idea. Mm-hmm. All right. Apple introduced iTunes 9 at its special media event in San Francisco on September 9th. The new version of iTunes includes a new interface and a Genius Mixes feature, along with the ability to organize iPhone and iPod Touch apps for syncing back to your handheld. Genius Mixes can build 12 different song mixes that go well together. The mixes can play endlessly, too. Apple said the new feature is like having a, quote, genius DJ, unquote.
But with probably with fewer drugs and fewer sunglasses.
Most likely. I don't know. It probably depends on your Mac.
It might.
Anyhow, no doubt a welcome feature for many iPhone and iPod Touch users. iTunes 9 supports application management, so users don't have to organize apps by...
Yay!
Yeah, that's right. Tapping, they don't have... Let me try that again. They can organize apps by tapping and dragging on their handheld. There we go. Users can set which apps appear on each homepage and change a sync to the handheld when it is connected to their computer. iTunes 9 includes the ability to sync music with your iPod based on genre or artist. It also includes home sharing, so up to 5 computers in the same home can easily share content. And it also includes the rumored Facebook integration, too. Yeah. Apple also dropped a new album format in our laps. They call it iTunes LP. It bundles additional multimedia content, such as interactive liner notes, behind-the-scenes videos, band photos, and more with music album downloads.
Microsoft this week announced and released the long-awaited... Wait, who are we kidding, Jeff? No one gives a crap about this piece. All right, let's try that again. Microsoft released the Zune HD this week, an upgrade to its digital media device product line that was first introduced back in May. As was the case in May, no one cares. Be that as it may, we should tell you that the Zune HD has an HD radio tuner, which admittedly puts it ahead of everything save Apple's new iPod Nano 5G, though even there, Apple is just a basic FM tuner built into the device. The company also plans to add Twitter and Facebook apps, catching the Zune HD up to the iPod from, I don't know, what, circa 2007? Oh, man, nice job. Yeah. Nice job, guys.
Score.
Oh, wait. There's a new weather app and a new calculator.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Why the humdrum apps for the device, you ask? And, well, you should. Microsoft has decided that it needs to be more efficient and has banned the Zune HD from third-party apps, as that is the provenance of the Windows Mobile team, said Zune marketing manager Brian Seitz. Quote, we're trying to get out of the business of building similar things in the company that don't work together, and the Windows Mobile team is tackling the challenge of a mobile apps marketplace right now, unquote. And once he was done, that thunderous clap you heard was the sound of 10 million simultaneous facepalms. Frickin' bozos. How the hell did they ever get in this position of being so important? We'll talk about it later.
All right. And the unfortunately named Rod Roddenberry is selling a bit of Trek and Mac history in the form of his pop's Mac 128K. Gene Roddenberry was given the Mac 128K by Apple, and the company went the extra mile by upgrading it to a Mac Plus for the Star Trek creator. As Gene doesn't need it anymore, Rod decided to sell it, along with some other Star Trek memorabilia, like Trek uniforms, phasers, disruptors, and tricorders, and more. More specifically, he's selling these items through Profiles in History, and that's an auction house that specializes in Hollywood-related memorabilia. Now, and this is important, Profiles in History is a fairly savvy auction house, and they realized they could get extra coverage of this auction, the eloquently named Featured Auction 37.
It just flows off the lips, doesn't it?
Totally
flows
does.
Off the tongue.
Yeah.
Featured Auction. Say it.
Featured Auction 37. Yes. Wow. Well, anyhow, they figured they could get extra coverage for the auction by pimping Gene's Mac 128K out to the Mac web.
Which worked.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Profiles in History is not quite so savvy when it comes to the esoteric goings-on of legacy Macs. The company presented this Mac as the first ever Mac Plus with a serial number ending in 0001. We reported it as such. Oops. But our readers were more on the ball than we were, and by we, I mean Brian.
Yeah.
And recognized that this Mac is an upgraded Mac 128K. Said TMO reader Ivoid, quote,
Isn't the M001 in the serial number a reference to the model number and not an indication that this was the first one produced? The serial number decoder at MacFact.org seems to agree that the M001 is the model number indicator in the serial number, and also that this is the Mac 128K, not a Mac Plus, that there might have been an upgrade from the 128 to the Mac Plus.
End quote. Well, iVoid was absolutely right, as were many other readers who noted other inconsistencies, which quickly got Profiles in History to issue a correction. So, it really is Gene's Mac, but it was a Mac 128K upgraded to a Mac Plus, and it wasn't the first one made. All in all, the Mac community showed its coolness, and the idea of owning a Mac that Gene, I rock hard, Roddenberry used to work on Star Trek The Next Generation is even more cool.
And this story is presented with apologies to iVoid for the characterization of his voice that I employed.
Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe that really is his voice.
It may be. I kind of doubt it. I kind of doubt it. But it seemed appropriate.
Yeah.
Okay, that noise provided by the Atomic Love Bomb is time.
I love those guys.
Oh, they're awesome, but it means it's time for the Context Machine within the Context Machine, which is where Jeff and I delve a little more deeply. It's like we haven't done this in weeks or something.
That's so weird.
A little more deeply into the news to provide context for what's going on. So
that said, maybe we should provide some context for what's going on.
All right, well then, let's just go ahead and dig right the heck into ASCAP and BMI.
I kind of had a feeling that might be where you'd want to start.
Oh, man, let's offer some context here.
Oh, please do.
When we say the music industry, we are almost always referring to the major labels and or the RIAA, which is the Recording Industry Association of America, that represents the labels. They're the ones who have made all the mistakes when it comes to, you know, trying to copy protect CDs, when it comes to trying to sue all the music fans out of existence. They're the ones who have urged higher and higher prices for music downloads. They're the ones who tried to block iTunes. They're the ones who said they wanted a piece of the damned iPod hardware sales. Right? They're the ones who have just been screwing up the music industry for, you know, certainly for the last 10 years, if, you know, and depending on how you want to look at it, maybe for the last 40 or 50 years, maybe forever, modern music industry.
Yeah, I'm thinking today's, we can trace it all the way back to wax rolls.
Probably, yeah. Once artists no longer made their living from actual live performances, is when the... Anyway, that's another story. Today's story was about ASCAP and BMI. And what these two organizations are, they're song publishers, basically. So you publish your song through one of these groups, which is a lot different than getting it recorded and released through... an album of some sort. And what ASCAP and BMI do is they collect the royalties from performances of your music. For instance, if you're at a dance club or a bar that's playing music over the sound system that's a significant part of the entertainment for being there, that bar is actually having to pay royalties to ASCAP and BMI for the privilege of doing so. Right? It's a public performance.
Right.
If, let's say that some band, I don't know, Dave Matthews, wants to cover a song by the Atomic Love Bombs.
I can totally see why he would.
Yep. And they should do that. We would end up getting paid not through the RIA or the music labels, we'd actually end up getting paid through ASCAP and BMI.
Right.
Okay. So that's what these groups do. And now what they're saying is they're basically, you know, they're looking at shrinking revenues from the fact that the music industry is imploding and killing itself. And their solution to this is to get Apple and Amazon, the retailers, to pay money for stupid crap.
We should be doing a video podcast right now because I'm still shaking my head in disbelief.
I want to do a video podcast of me taking a baseball bat to someone's head over this. I mean, this is so ridiculous. I mean, okay, so let's look at this. First of all, the songwriters are getting paid for whatever kind of negotiations they have for whomever owns the TV shows and movies that they're talking about.
Right.
That's where they're getting their money. And if they want,
they actually get it twice, from what I understand, because they get paid when a studio produces the show or movie, and then they get paid from whoever it is that's actually broadcasting the performance. So they get paid twice.
Yeah, and each time a TV show is played, whomever owns the songwriting royalties or the songwriting rights to a song, they're getting paid each time.
Right.
So, in my mind, if they want to change the way they're getting paid from these downloads, they need to not look to Apple and Amazon and Hulu or you know, whatever Microsoft eventually throws into the mix for, you know, their attempt to mess up this industry. They need instead to look at the way the negotiations are going through the studios. Whoever it is that's licensing the material out to iTunes and to Hulu, that's where they need to look for this money, not from the retailers. It's freaking ridiculous to think that Apple should be paying them extra money for content produced by other people.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing with trying to sidestep, in essence, part of the music industry and go right out to the retailers, to me seems kind of odd because, as far as I know, that doesn't happen in other parts of the industry.
No, it's beyond incomprehensible, and it's even more incomprehensible that they want to get paid for the previews, which serve to sell the music. People aren't listening to the previews for the entertainment value of those previews. People aren't like logging into iTunes and listening to songs 30 seconds at a time to go hip hip hoorah. The previews exist for one thing and one thing only, which is to sell the music, which is where the where they should be making their money.
All right, so I have a question, and I'm assuming you don't know the answer, and I certainly don't know the answer. When someone goes to their local music store, Barnes & Noble, Borders, whatever, and they go to one of those kiosks where the CDs are already preloaded for what's on sale, and they choose to listen to samples before buying an album, are those stores having to pay royalties back to ASCAP or BMI?
Well, those preview systems are almost always managed by a third party and licensed from a third party. And I don't know whether or not there's a performance, public performance fee that's associated with them. I kind of doubt it, but I don't know. But if a music store is playing a CD over their sound system, they would actually be required to pay the public performance fee.
Yeah, and ASCAP actually sends people out to public places to see if music is being played.
Yeah, absolutely. And as well they should. I mean, you know, if a bar is making money from, or a club is making money from the performance of music over the system, the songwriting copyright holder there should be a public performance fee paid
there
for that.
There we go. Yeah, and that totally makes sense, because that's exactly what it is. It's a public performance, and someone is making money based at least in part on that music.
Yeah, no one's making any money from a 30-second preview.
No, they're not.
And if
I'm going to disagree with you. That 30-second preview is making someone money, and that is the record labels. And then, hopefully, ultimately, all of the talent that was involved in making that song.
But it's actually not. It only makes money if it's related to a song.
Say. Right. So that's what I mean. Those clips are critical to helping sell songs.
Yes.
So they are indirect revenue generators, and someone is making money from those samples being played.
Yes. Yes. But they're not generating revenue on their own.
Right.
When someone plays a 30-second preview, Apple actually is losing money because they're paying for bandwidth.
Apple does not
recoup that money until they actually sell a song. And many, many more previews are played than songs are purchased.
True. And then if you take into account things like the free song of the week, I mean, think of all the people that are going to preview that song, and then Apple's going to turn around and give it away for free.
True, but that's an agreement. That's an agreement with the labels. They're putting all those packages together and for hopes of promotion.
True, but my point is with that Apple is providing that bandwidth without charging anyone extra for it. So should Apple be charging the music labels bandwidth fees?
Well, you know, maybe or maybe not. No, I mean, no, they shouldn't.
Right. I'm just being an ass at this point.
Yeah. This thing with BMI and ASCAP is just insane. It's just that, you know, these freaking organizations need to stop trying to make money from nothing, and that's all they want to do is they want to make money from nothing, and this is such the pursuit of unearned profits, and it just drives me bananas.
Well, this is a tough time for the labels and the music industry, recording industry in general, because they're having to deal with major changes in their whole business model. And I don't think they like that at all. And they like the old style, and they're being drug kicking and screaming into the new style. And if they don't figure out how to work with it, as opposed to trying to force their old ways on what's happening now, we're going to have a different set of music labels in a little while.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it would be different, by the way, if each... I mean, God forbid this happen, but like, if each 30-second promo, each 30-second sample was accompanied with an ad, right? Or, you know, if there was some kind of paid advertisement that was associated with the playing of 30-second clips, well, then they actually would have I think a fair argument to be made that a public performance fee should be paid. But this is not the case.
Oh my God! If they were doing that, that would drive me fracking insane.
Yeah, well, it would just turn people off.
Oh, yeah.
Just like higher prices are going to turn people off. The music technology and digital distribution makes the production and distribution of music cheaper, and the labels need to embrace this idea. They need to embrace it and find ways to grow the industry through the proliferation of more sales, not try to maximize the profits from each sale, because they can't. They cannot do it. And they're choking and killing themselves. And this additional nonsense is only going to harm the industry more, especially should it become law. Now, we can hope that this will not become law. I would be shocked if this were to I mean, this is too illogical even for you know, the vast majority of politicians to sign on to.
I would hope that they wouldn't want to sign on to this. I mean, they have enough to worry about already with mm-hmm. the legislation that they have to deal with just on a daily basis, and then the high-profile things that they're trying to deal with right now. This, I'm hoping, just kind of goes to the wayside, as it should.
Let's hope. So let's actually contrast. This is a great segue for us, Jeff. Let's contrast this with what I think is a way of embracing the new.
Mm-hmm. I know right where you're going with this, and I'm just totally loving it.
Of course, because we talked about it ahead of time.
Yeah, we did.
But Apple has done. I just made that sound. Apple has done.
That's our own
what
special
it is,
inside joke, everyone. Sorry.
What it is that I believe that the industry, or I'm sorry, Apple has given us an example of doing what it is that I think that the rest of the music industry should be doing. And we're talking about iTunes LP, which was a kind of, you know, somewhat overlooked aspect of iTunes 9 from the media event that I thought was just really, really cool. And I think that until you've seen it and experienced it, you might not understand its coolness. So I thought maybe we could talk about that.
Okay. I think that sounds like a great idea. And I will jump in by saying that Apple gets how to take advantage of the new media that we have in front of us now, as opposed to trying to force old media styles into our new technology world. And that's great.
Agreed, and that's part of why they've been so successful. And so I mean, I don't think that iTunes LP is going to change the world or anything, but I think it's really cool, and this is why. If you're old enough to remember LPs, and I'm not old enough to remember, say, the 38s before that, and I don't know how that generation, like the Sinatra fan generation, you know, I don't know how excited they were about getting a 38 wait, is it 38? Am I 78?
78.
Good Lord.
A 38, yeah, 30. Brian, that's a caliber of handgun.
Yeah, and a 33, of course, is the RPMs of of an LP, which is why it's called an LP. So, I don't know how that generation dealt with 78s. I do know how the half generation that came before me and then half of my generation dealt with LPs, which was, you know, you take it and you look at the album art and, you know, you marvel at the coolness that is the musicians and how they came up with this and, you know, and whatever.
Yeah, and then there was always the cool liner notes that gave you the special insight that people that didn't have the album wouldn't be able to get.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, those few special albums that actually opened up.
Oh yes,
you know, and you get the extra liner notes that way, or the extra information, or the extra pictures. I remember, you know, while music would be playing, while I'm playing a record on a turntable, I remember holding the album cover and just, you know, looking at it and reading it, and that's what we all did,
right. Well, okay, there's a few of our friends that were dealing with stems and seeds, but the rest of us, we were looking at the album art.
Well, fair enough. You're a funny man, Jeff. And, you know, CD, there was still a little bit of that with the CDs, but I think a lot less so. Cassettes made music throwaway, which I think was a mistake. I mean, that was when the labels really started to get everything wrong, as they were looking at the higher profitability and the disposableness of cassettes.
But there's so many things that are wrong with the cassette format.
Oh yeah,
I mean, the audio quality is crap. You couldn't make things fit the same way you did on an LP, so your tracks didn't match, or you didn't even have all your tracks. And then there's no place for liner notes, and the album art was just crap because it didn't fit right.
Yeah, it was all tiny, and, you know, God forbid trying to read a lyric sheet from a cassette.
Yeah.
If it actually even had one. And you know, and so this is when they started devaluing their own product in the pursuit of profits. This is when they started to training people that music was disposable and didn't matter. Is with cassettes. Be that as it may, CDs brought a little bit of that album experience back, just a little bit, because now there was a little bit more room for printed material. There's the liner notes were a little bit bigger. And, you know, it probably took about 10, 12 years for bands and labels to actually design the presentation of albums with CDs in mind, as opposed to trying to convert the LP format to a CD. But it did eventually happen.
True. Now, of course, for a while, we had this overlap where albums were being released on vinyl, cassette, and CD at the same time.
Right. Right. And it's funny, there's been a resurgence in LPs, at least out here on the West Coast.
I'm going to guess it's everywhere. It's a big thing here in Denver, too.
Which is really interesting to me. Okay, so now, cut to the digital thing. And one of the very first things, like the reason why, for instance, Metallica was all up in arms about iTunes was because people could buy singles instead of buying whole albums. And artists felt that they basically had the right to present their work as a whole, and that fans didn't have the right to pick and choose what they wanted to buy.
You know, I'll agree with that in certain situations, but in many cases, I think artists are selling themselves short by forcing consumers to buy an entire album instead of just the songs they want. Now, something like The Wall or Tommy, okay, that's an ensemble piece. You need to have the whole thing.
You do, but at the same time, I kind of understand that there are people who just want the crappy disco song Run or another Brick in the Wall Part 2, because
that was awesome getting all the radio play at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, and because it's really cool because kids are saying, hey, teacher, leave the kids alone, and, you know, that's like a representation of me rebelling.
Okay, so now back when... yeah, there you go. So... I can't imagine you rebelling against anything, Brian.
Wow, I've never been so insulted.
I mean, sorry.
That may actually be the single biggest insult anyone has ever given me. I've been called fat, I am. I've been called stupid, I'm not. I've been called stubborn, you know, all right, fair enough. But never rebelling against anything?
Now, so, see, clearly my sarcastic joke delivery totally fell on its face there.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So as penance, I will iron my hands as soon as we're done recording the podcast. where was I? Oh, okay, I remember what my point was, or comment was going to be. All right, so... when we were dealing with people going out and buying LPs, we also had the singles. Mm-hmm. So there'd be the whole album, and then there'd be the popular song, and then the B-side that would be released mm-hmm. as a single. Now, artists were okay with that, I'm assuming.
Well, they were, in fact. They were okay with that for the longest time. Of course, Metallica was never really a singles band.
True.
To be fair to them.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
I wonder if Sandman was released as a single. That would crack me up. That would really crack me up. But, of course, you know, don't even get me started on Lars Ulrich's hypocrisy, you know, bitching about fans stealing music when he himself bragged about copying other band members' albums. in their living room when he was a kid. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. Albums, the album experience, right? So the whole point is this: the album experience has largely been absent from the world of music for probably the last decade and a half, maybe 2 decades.
I'm going to say 2 decades. Because once people started buying cassettes, I think that pretty much threw the album as we know it out the window.
Yeah, but true. True. And we're just taking forever to get to our point here, but what Apple has done with iTunes LP is try to bring that album experience back to music, and they're doing it for a big reason. Bands, again, and labels get tense about music fans being able to buy what they want because it doesn't allow them to get money for crap, and you know they can't have that. And and you know there was to a certain extent there's this concept of the album as a whole work of art being sort of supplanted by a singles culture that was growing up around iTunes, and what Apple has done with iTunes LP is to try to bring that album experience back by making it an experience to have an album. And what I think is really cool about it is they have done so, in my opinion, not by trying to, you know, do something stupid like offer the digital analog of, you know, of the 3D album, like, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, you've got the album and you can spin it around, and, you know, I mean, they didn't do anything like that. They didn't try to duplicate the album experience. Instead, what I think they did is identified the thing that people think of as the album experience and figure out how to offer that through a computer screen.
And see, and that's the brilliant part, because that's what everyone should have been doing all along once we hit this digital age with music, and mm-hmm. everyone was simply trying to take what we had before, which was printed material, mm-hmm. and find a way to just force that into our computer screens. And I'm not trying to devalue the all of the artwork and all the work that went into creating those albums and album covers. Back when everyone was buying vinyl all the time, that was brilliant for the media that it was. Now we have a new media, and we should look at all of this in a different way.
We should, and I think Apple has done that with iTunes LP, and I think it's a really cool thing. So we should probably get around to describing it. What iTunes LP is a way of navigating through an album, be it, you know, to pick your songs, be it to read the lyrics, be it to get the liner notes, or be it to get the extra content like additional videos that may have been included by the band. I don't think every iTunes LP is going to come with videos, but some of them will. My joke during the media event was that, you know, buy the Doors album called The Doors, where you two can watch Ray Manzarek live in the past. Because that's what Ray, that's what, other than playing keyboard, it's what Ray Manzarek does second best. First best being play keyboard, second best would be living in the past. But you can navigate through all this stuff in a way that is engaging, and, you know, it looks really cool. And like I said, you know, when I was watching them demo this on the stage, I felt like I had an album in my hand, sort of. I mean, not really, but I mean, but I felt that album thing just by watching them do it.
But it didn't feel like a substitute for an album, right? It felt like an album in a new way.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And an album in a better way. I mean, you know, I enjoy bands. I enjoy music. I've always liked reading stuff. And of course, you know, with the internet, a lot of stuff that may have been, you know, seen on an album only if we're lucky, probably never at all. You know, that sort of thing is all over the internet. But this is a way of doing it right from within iTunes, you know, right when you buy the full album. And I think it's really cool. I think it's really cool, and I hope that it becomes a big deal.
I hope it does too. I think one thing Apple's going to have to do to help make this into a big deal is to add more of the iTunes LP content to the information that gets synced over to your iPhone or iPod Touch. Because right now,
right,
you really need to sit at your computer because this has to be done in iTunes.
Right, which is interesting because it seems to both Jeff and I that the iPhone should be, you know, a great vehicle for navigating through this stuff, just being able to touch the screen.
Right. And, you know, another... I thought of this just as soon as you said touch the screen, because we have the Apple TV remote, the new one, mm-hmm, where, you know, we just swipe and move on our iPhone or mm-hmm iPod Touch. What a great way to navigate through all this content on your Apple TV also. And then you've true got it on your big screen.
Yeah, true. True, yeah. Yeah, you know, it could actually bring us back to people actually looking at the album while they're listening to music, which, you know, it probably won't because there's so much competition for attention these days.
But you know, I bet
whatever
the hardcore fans would sit on their couch in front of their TV and watch all of the iTunes LP stuff while they're listening to the album. And I bet you'd get some people that are nostalgic for the days when they sat in their beanbag chair with the album sleeve while they're mm-hmm listening to the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be. It could be. It certainly should, I think, at least increase album sales again.
I think that's so we'll likely. See. Yeah.
And it's gonna depend on how many labels and bands embrace this. For instance, my band, the Atomic Love Bombs, our CD is available on iTunes for $9.99. It's available at Amazon, I think, for $7.99. But whatever. The point is that I have no idea how it is that an independent band would put together an iTunes LP format yet. And I'm guessing that the company that we went through to publish or to get our stuff on iTunes probably doesn't know yet either. So, you know, and there's an increasing percentage of music being produced that is the independent nature. So, you know, it's, I don't know, there's going to be a lot of things that have to come together for iTunes LP to matter.
So what Apple needs is iTunes LP SDK. Of sorts.
Yes, of sorts, yes. Yes, they do. And they also need to feature the Atomic Love Bombs on iTunes.
They should. And
I'm just saying.
Okay, so I just have to say that I love your album. And I listen to it, and people, go take a listen to it. And I know we're doing all the shameless plugging for the Atomic Love Bombs album, but I really like it. So I'm okay doing the shameless plugs because there should be no shame involved in that. It really is a good album.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. I appreciate that muchly. So let's move on. What do we have? Do we have any need to mock Zune HD anymore?
You know, we could mock it, or we could tell people to go listen to the other podcasts that we've been on where we mock it.
Well, let's look at this one particular thing that I think is just fascinating in that it so clearly offers this like poster child example of the difference between Microsoft and Apple.
Oh, I know where you're going. Yes. Okay. This is a good thing for us to go into. So hop on the soapbox.
All right. Here, let me move it into place here. Okay. Stepladder. Okay. Friends, countrymen, gentlemen, fans, Mac users, I am here before you to tell you that how in the hell did Microsoft become a big deal? That's what I'm here to do. All right. So seriously, we got the quote where we were talking about how the Microsoft people just figured that they needed to stop duplicating features in different products. And on the face of it, that sounds, you know, it's like, oh, it's about time you figured this out. You know, there's no reason for, let's give an example of this. There's no reason for Xbox Live to, you know, be working on the same Xbox Live experience that when, you know, and then having the Windows team trying to do something similar for just the computers.
Right.
You know, but rather than killing it off on one or the other, they should probably try to unite them. And such is the case with the Zune HD and Windows Mobile. So Microsoft realized that they're wasting resources on redundant development, and rather than understanding where that development should be in sync, instead they're treating these different products as separate and unrelated entities, which is balderdash.
Yeah, it's a big problem, and it looks to me as if Microsoft has not figured this one out yet. You can't run all your divisions and develop all your products in isolation. If you can't get that that homogeny between all the products, you're wasting resources, you're wasting energy, and you're missing out on marketing opportunities.
Right. And the funny thing is that they have the blueprint for doing it right in front of them.
Yeah, down the road in Cupertino.
Yeah. I mean, they're doing everything they can to try to out iPhone the iPhone and out iPod the iPod, and yet they can't realize that Apple looks at the iPod Touch as an extension of the iPhone. I mean, you know, I mean, the iPod Touch and the iPhone share this incredible resource, which is the third-party app developers. And Apple has figured out a way to leverage it across both platforms. And then Microsoft's response to that is to offer a device which is specifically competing against the iPod Touch, but not let it have anything to do with Windows Mobile. That's just, I mean, it's just retarded. How can they not understand that?
It's a different mentality about the products. And if you look at what Apple does, they sit there and look at, I'm hesitant to use the word. They have a holistic view on their products. And so they're looking at how all the pieces fit together, how each product they make, whether it's hardware and software, can benefit from the other products that Apple makes, and how it can benefit those things too. And Microsoft has this approach where they develop something and then just push it, and it's done it in this isolated fashion. So you have Windows, and so that is the operating system that's pushed out to generic PC vendors. Mm-hmm. And yes, I know I'm lumping Dell and Gateway and companies like that in that group, but just the PC vendor market. Okay, right. So that's one path they're following. Then they have another path, which is, let's make an operating system for devices that fit in your hand or in your pocket. And that's completely isolated because they're not thinking, how can we create this world where all of those devices fit together? That's what Apple right. does. Microsoft creates things, pushes them out. And when you're looking to make a whole product, and I'm being very general here because I'm looking at Apple. So they're making a whole product, and that product is an operating system, software setup, and large hardware and pocket-sized hardware that all can work together. That's the product. At Microsoft, they're looking at how do we gain and lock in market share.
Yep. You know, it comes back to, you know, that story I've told about Steve Capps telling me that the difference between Microsoft and Apple. Do you remember that story?
I'm going to set it up and say, no, Brian, I don't. Tell that to me,
well,
please.
I don't want to get into the huge, to all the details again, because I've talked about it many times. But the short version is that what Steve Capps, who worked at both companies in the 90s, and well, Apple in the 80s and early 90s, and then Microsoft in the 90s. What he sort of basically describes this situation where at Apple, you've got people looking at the whole picture, and at Microsoft, you've got people who have been, you know, broken down and are looking only at their little tiny, tiny part of the picture, even if it's within a broader product, like, say, Windows. And no one's thinking about the whole picture. No one can put the kibosh on anything, et cetera. And I think this is an example of that. There's no one at Microsoft, especially since Bill is, you know, not CEO anymore, there's no one at Microsoft that's looking at the whole picture. Steve Ballmer is not a product guy. He's a marketing guy. And he's certainly not looking at the whole picture. I don't think he's capable of doing it.
I don't think he is either. And you're right. He's a marketing guy. He looks at the whole thing from just the market share standpoint, as far as I can tell. And
yeah, it's like, you know, it's like when they gave that contest winner
for
Windows Media. Made the winner of a Windows Media app development contest an iPhone app.
Yeah, how about that?
Who the hell let an iPhone app into this contest in the first place?
See, there I go again. I'm encouraging you.
Well, there's a lot of setup for that.
I know. We went through, 45 minutes of show just to build up to that.
Stephen Colbert would have been proud.
I'm sure he would.
Anyway, be that as it may, so I think this is just a fine example of that. For some reason, the people at Microsoft can't understand that the reduction of redundancy should mean that they look at the Zune HD as an extension of the Windows Mobile line rather than something that's separate. And if they can't do that, then maybe they need to look at Windows Mobile as being an extension of the damn Zune HD line.
That's not going to happen.
Well, probably not.
But
yeah. I mean, they need to do something. It's ridiculous to not have third-party app development for a product like Zune HD, especially for Microsoft, a company that has always done a much better job of taking care of its developers than Apple has, until maybe recently.
Yeah, and now, oh, the irony, we have people swarming to the App Store.
Mm-hmm.
And how many developers are swarming to the Zune platform?
Yeah,
oh, that's right. They can't.
Where's the hacker community making jailbreaking the Zune HD so they can run apps on it?
Yeah,
and if anyone knows of something out there like that, please let me know.
Yeah, actually, that would be really interesting to follow. If there is something like that out there, do let us know, because I would be very intrigued to dive into that seedy, dark underworld of what's going on in the Zune
jailbreaking community.
Yeah, I was going to say raves, but it wasn't going to work out.
All right, we should probably cut this short in that we've already gone way long. We should probably bring this to a close, though.
Just don't cut it short. We can't.
There's a couple of things, though, Jeff. We were going to name the winner of Bob's book contest.
That's right.
Okay, I don't know where my dice are.
Okay, well then...
So I'm gonna find them for next week.
Okay, so then how about if we say anyone that has not yet sent us an email...
Yes, let's definitely keep registration open for that for another week, or at least until we do another show, which could be a week, it could be a month, could be a couple of years.
It'll happen.
Go ahead and register. And we're talking about Mac OS X Snow Leopard for Dummies.
From Bob, Dr. Mac Levitis.
Yep, and he is going to autograph it, and he's going to send it directly to you himself. All you have to do is send us an email at acm@macobserver.com and tell us you want to enter into the drawing for Bob's book, and we will take care of it. And then for our next show, we're going to do the selection process live.
We'll be here, and we'll be alive.
You're going to hear it. Yes, and you'll hear it, and just like we did our last little contest.
So
it'll
be live, recorded earlier.
Yes, for you, but not for us.
Right.
And this will give us incentive to make sure we get a show done next week, too.
All right, that's fair enough.
Yeah. And thanks for joining us. So why don't we close it out, Jeff?
Okay. Actually, you know what? Before we close it out, I guess we should tell people stuff about the stuff we have coming up where they can actually see us.
Yes, please
do. So, all right. So the first thing we have is September – hold on. I have to look at the calendar so I get the date right. September 22nd. So if you're in Colorado, Denver, Boulder area, whatever, the Boulder Writers Alliance is having an expo, and I will be speaking there.
Yay!
Yeah. So that'll be fun. I've done that the past few years, and it's always a neat event. And then we're actually – both of us are going to be in the same place in public.
Really? So people will finally know that we're not the same person?
Right. And
they'll have proof.
They'll have proof. Yeah. So that's going to be on October 3rd, and that's at the Mac Computer Expo. And that is – in Petaluma, California.
Yep, it is. It's going to be fun.
Right.
I think we're going to be giving away some goodies there too, right? Some software and stuff?
Actually, we are. And we have some very cool stuff lined up.
We should see if Bob wants to have some more copies of his books given away too.
Oh, that's a great idea.
That's very clever of us. Yeah, so apparently, well, I don't know. I'm assuming that Bob will say yes. But we may be giving away more copies of this book.
Yeah, so until Bob really says yes, we'll just hope that he will. So, but that's going to be cool because we're both going to be there. And then I'm going to be doing a session at the event where I'm talking about all the cool things you can do with your iPhone or iPod Touch to take it beyond just what it is out of the box.
Right, which is really cool.
Yeah, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
All right, great. Now I'll take us out.
Okay, now I'll take us out. If you have anything to comment on, add a question, send your audio or text comments to acm@macobserver.com. And remember, succinctness is next to steveliness. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. I still have to think about it sometimes, so I get the name right. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sending us your comments and feedback. And feel free to follow me on Twitter. That's at twitter.com/jgamut, so you can see all the weird things that happen in my head throughout the day.
And you can follow me at TM O'Brien. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. Our theme song is Push Me Under by the Atomic Love Bombs, a great band, and that's all for this week.
And as always, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer. Down.
I can't see a way out now. I will not go, no matter how. You push me under, you hold me down. After all, I think I'd rather.